I wish it was all, folks, but here comes the Colonel.
Porky Pig. I can't believe how Porky Pig got on this program. How did that happen? My producers tell me somebody leave the back door open. All right, well, welcome back to the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. So glad that you joined us again. In just a minute, we're going to get back to today's guest. We have Mike Pack, who is the executive director of the Groundwater Protection Council and has been in that position since 1983, so he's an old hand at what we're going to talk about today. And Mike Nicholas is his chief geologist. And the question came up is about fracking. And we've been very concerned in this program and tried to cover fracking dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and everybody seems to be still very skeptical because it seems like every day something new comes to us about some sort of anti-fracking story. They tell us that it's ridiculous, that there are some things to be worried about environmentally, but fracking isn't one of them. And we're getting back more into that in just a little bit, about all that stuff that's being pumped into the ground to take the place of the stuff that we're extracting out of it. So apparently it's pretty interesting. And of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And want to remind you that coming up on the 19th and 20th in Tulsa, Oklahoma, is the 4th Annual Green Technologies Conference. All right, before we get back with Mike Nicholas and Mike Pack, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help
you? All right, once again, we've loaded the fountain with our coins, and so we have bought his attention. Welcome, O Spirit of the Fountain. Now then, for today's query, if you're from New York, you probably know this the answer to this one. Otherwise, O Spirit of the Fountain, here's a stumper for you. What storied Manhattan neighborhood is located between Chelsea and Soho on the Lower West Side?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the other.
The Spirit of the Fountain one more time has come back with the correct answer. The storied Manhattan neighborhood, located between Chelsea and Soho on the Lower West Side. If you said Greenwich Village, you're absolutely correct. All right, well, let's get back to our program. All right, this stuff, then, it's expected that once it's pumped back in there and fills up those voids and things like that, that it's going to be there forever. It's not going to shift around, and it's not going to cause a problem maybe 50, 100 years down the road.
No, it won't. As a matter of fact, the Earth will keep trying to press it down, and it will compress it. And at times, you have to refracture the rock simply because you lose what we call porosity, which is the amount of open space between the rock grains. Same thing happens in fracturing. Sometimes you have to refracture because they will close up on you if you can't keep them propped open. So basically, Earth heals itself pretty quickly, and these are such minor events that there's no cause for any alarm from a surface perspective.
Well, we hear that the substance that you're pumping in to fracture the rock so we can extract the oil and gas is pretty nasty stuff. And if cattle drink it or it gets in an area that really contaminates an area, are we really contaminating the ground with some really nasty stuff? I mean, what is this liquid that we're pumping in? And how do we pump it in? That's another question, too. Is there great pressure that's sent down there, or is it the gravitational pull of the Earth that causes this liquid to fracture the rock? Or what's the process here, Mike?
Well, the fluid has to be pumped down under pressure, because what you have to do is you have to overcome the natural pressure in the rock itself. In other words, the rock has a shear point where over which the pressure will cause it to separate or fracture. And you have to pump over that in order to get the fluids in there and to get the proppant in there. Now, the fact of the matter is that the reason they use chemicals is they have very specific purposes. For example, biocides. They prevent the buildup of biologic contamination in a well. They have scale inhibitors to prevent scale buildup on the inside of the well. Things like this. And the point of those is once they're pumped down, they actually will react with the rock, because that's their actual purpose, is they are reactive chemicals. So what comes back in what we call flowback fluid or produced water contains only very, very small portions of what originally went down and some byproducts of what went down. And in fact, what goes down initially is a very, very small proportion of the total amount of fluid. For example, a hydraulic fracturing job may consist of 80% water, 14 or 15% sand, other benign chemicals, and then probably less than 0.5% to 1% at most of other chemicals. And some of these chemicals are the same sorts of chemicals you would see in common use today, things like guar gum. Guar gum is used as a thickener in ice cream, for example. Not to say that some of these chemicals aren't hazardous or don't have hazardous components, but many chemicals do. All chemicals are toxic in the right amounts, but these are relatively small totals by mass of the total volume going down the well. And because of the well construction with cement and casing, they're prevented from coming back up into the groundwater zone. So they are trapped in these oil and gas bearing zones, many of which, of course, contain some of the same sorts of chemicals like what we could refer to as BTEX. You've probably heard of this, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are common components of hydrocarbons. So if you're fracturing a hydrocarbon zone, these are already present in the hydrocarbon zone. You're not fracturing freshwater, you're fracturing zones that already contain oil and gas. So that's the reason we don't have a great deal of concern. The small volumes, the control over the well, the fact that these chemicals actually react downhole and change, and a lot of them stay downhole, in fact. They stay in the spaces of the rock itself, and they actually react with the rock chemistry and can stay in the rock. So there's very little concern about these getting back up into groundwater. When you talk about spills at the surface, certainly we have concerns about that. And that's, as Mike Pake said, that's why we have regulatory structures in the states. The states have the capability of reacting quickly and decisively to surface spills, both with mandatory cleanup plans and as necessary civil and criminal penalties if they're needed. So from that standpoint, yes, there are some potential issues, very, very small percentage of likelihood of a problem from the actual hydraulic fracturing job itself.
All right. Well, as being concerned primarily with groundwater protection and the Groundwater Protection Council, you may not want to address this next subject, but as a geologist, Mike Nicholas, maybe you can. A story last week out of the Denver Post, another scare story about fracking. That story says people living within a half mile of oil and gas well fracking operations were exposed to air pollutants five times above a federal hazard standard, according to a new Colorado study. The University of Colorado School of Public Health Analysis is one of a string of studies in Wyoming, Utah, and eastern Colorado that highlight air quality impacts of drilling and hydraulic fracking. And with that kind of air pollution, that is another big blow to the practice of fracking. Do you have any comment about that?
Actually, no. I'm not an air expert in any way, shape, or form, and I wouldn't want to pose a answer to something like that. So I'm afraid I can't. I don't know if Mike Bake would like to address it or not, but.
No, I'd pass. I would like to talk about water management, Colonel, if I could.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, please.
Step on your question. One of the things to follow up on Mike Nicholas's explanation on the chemical reaction and the use of the chemicals, when the flowback water that does come to the surface is at the surface, this is where people get concerned, and they should get concerned. There's a whole regulatory program for managing that water called the Underground Injection Control Program. It's been around since it's been used for 60, 70 years, but as a legal entity federally, it's been around since the mid to late 70s. And most all the states, with a few exceptions, manage, instead of the federal government, manage their underground injection control program. And that program, pre-shale gas development, was managing billions of gallons of water, some say a day, nonetheless, massive volumes of water 24/7 and 365 days of the year from conventional oil production and gas production and disposing it underground, produced salt water and that sort of thing. And that's a very well understood program, and it's the key use of that program that allows us to dispose of this flowback water, underground injection control, and in almost all the states, with Pennsylvania being a notable exception due to geology, the underground injection control program is what's used to dispose of the flowback water. I might add too that, and if you wanted to get into it, we might refer the listeners to a terrific site that's been developed by the Groundwater Protection Council on Chemicals, Colonel, and we have a partner in the Interstate Oil and Gas Compact Commission. But that website is fracfocus.org, fracfocus.org. And if the listener would go to that website, they will see posted over 12,000 wells that have been hydraulically fractured since April 11, 2011, by something approaching 150 companies. And in that list, you'll see how much water was used for the frack job, what chemicals, what the chemical abstract number is, what the ratio of the chemical was in the fracturing fluid, and what the ratio was in the total overall frack volume that would include the water, and all the locational information, and be able to get right into a well that's down the road from them and take a look at all the chemicals that were used in that particular hydraulic fracturing job. And I think it's a tremendous public asset, and it's been so successful that it's been adopted as a mandatory requirement. Frac Focus, reporting to Frac Focus, has been adopted as a mandatory requirement in Montana, North Dakota, Colorado, Texas, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, and it's in the rural pipeline in Oklahoma, talking about it in Kansas, and the number of states go on and on. And I think that there should be some assurance to the public that certainly the states and the participating companies are making every effort to make these chemicals transparent. And what you'll find then, if you look at these alleged contaminant sites, and there could be an exception, but we haven't heard of one yet, is that these chemicals don't appear. Methane appears, and I think Mike did a good job of answering that. And there are other problems with water wells, but these chemicals haven't been present in any large quantity in any of the fracturing jobs.
So we're kind of getting some conclusions here. We're finding out that fracturing is not going to be a worry about earthquakes, and we're not going to have to worry about fracturing causing widespread groundwater contamination. If we're going to worry about anything, it's going to have to be the story out of Colorado with the air pollution, but that's about it. Everything else is safe. Can you give us a something that we could tell the public? I mean, make an announcement. They have nothing to fear about fracking, or the fracking is perfectly safe, or the gee whiz, it's been done for a long time. Some real good strong statement we can come out with.
Well, it would really, just to repeat what I've said, hydraulic fracturing has been going on for 50 or 60 years in just vertical well development, and we just haven't seen the problems in hydraulic fracturing. But I want to be perfectly clear that we don't negate some of the problems, some of the things that do happen. But as far as hydraulic fracturing, that particular event in the life cycle of a well, we do not believe that the public has anything to fear from hydraulic fracturing. We believe it's a fairly well understood process. We know it's regulated. We know that the water that comes back up to the surface is highly regulated through the underground injection control program, and when and where problems have and do occur, that the states have a legacy of rules and procedures that they can use to enforce the highest standards.
All right. What have we missed? What have I neglected to ask? Because I've asked all the questions that keep getting asked of me, but what would you like to add to any of this that we haven't covered today?
Mike Nicholas?
if I were going to say one thing, I would say effectively that one of our primary concerns is that the time we spend on hydraulic fracturing and issues like that are really not high risk factors for groundwater contamination is time and money that can't be spent on things that really cause groundwater contamination, things we know about like pesticides and nutrients and septic systems and things that we know for a fact are causing groundwater contamination. We'd really like the public to focus on those issues and begin to help us build ways to protect groundwater from things that we know are causing groundwater contamination.
And if I could add, Colonel, there was a study just as a way of emphasizing what Mike Nicholas just said, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. There was a study done in Pennsylvania a number of years ago, early on in the shale development, to look for chemicals and get some ambient groundwater data, and they found that over 50% of the private wells failed basic fecal coliform. Failed it, basic fecal coliform test in their private wells, and that was because of misplaced septic tanks, misused septic tanks, livestock, inappropriate placement of livestock, that sort of thing. And those are real, real health concerns that affect groundwater, not to mention the other things that Mike talked about, the pesticides, nitrates, confined animal feeding operations, stormwater management. These are having a serious impact on groundwater, and we will be glad to join any group or person that wants to help go after some of these real contaminant sources. And from our point of view, we do spend a lot of time on hydraulic fracturing, and the numbers aren't there to justify the reaction and the massive, massive amount of money that's being spent by all sides of the argument over something that we just can't verify is having a major health impact, if any health impact, and compared to things that are really, really having a health impact that go just underattended.
All right, so we can say definitively then that people are scared about the wrong boogeyman. Fracking isn't it, but there are serious concerns that we can look at that fracking has nothing to do with in the protection of our water and our environment. That would kind of sum it up.
Yeah, that sums it up well.
All right, let's do this. Do either of you you gentlemen want to take a stab at a prediction for the future, either having to do with your own profession or who's going to win the World Series or when we're going to be free of foreign oil or something like that? How about a future prediction? Could you give us anything there?
I'll give you the most delightful one I can think of. The Green Bay Packers will win the Super Bowl this year or next. How's that?
Yeah, I know you're a you're a stockholder of the Green Bay Packers, Mike Pack. I know that, right?
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Mike, or Colonel, I would like to ask one thing. When Mike was listing off the states that have adopted Frac Focus, he mentioned New Mexico. New Mexico, we're talking with them, but they have not adopted Frac Focus as their requirement for reporting yet. Other than that, Mike was right on all the others.
All right, great. Well, what about you, Mike Nicholas? You have a prediction for the future that has maybe the New Orleans Saints taking on the Green Bay Packers?
I'm more of an Indianapolis Colts fan, although I don't know why. It was really funny to see Peyton Manning in an orange 18 jersey. So I'm having serious troubles with that. I think that this natural gas boom clearly has the potential to help free us up from many sources of foreign petroleum. Obviously, it's a huge game changer as far as energy in this country is concerned. And if I had to say one thing, I would say that any risks that there are that are reasonable in acquiring that energy are worth taking. I think we have a situation where we are going to have to, for geopolitical reasons and energy security reasons, get as much oil and gas production as we can in this country safely. So that's just an opinion, but
That leads me to something I heard Governor Kasich and Governor Hickenlooper, Ohio and Colorado, respectively, say several weeks ago at a meeting we were all at. The gas, as Governor Kasich said, the gas will come out of the ground in Ohio. And he said, but it'll come out safely at no harm to the environment. And he's been well quoted on that. But he goes on to talk about the incremental job increases, the chemical plants that are the major international chemical companies that can use the gas for chemical production that are not locating overseas, and they're producing things here now, or will be willing to build plants, and the amount of jobs that are created by this industry is breathtaking. And I think that as the process continues to evolve and the drilling program continues to move forward and gas is produced and products that it can bring to the market are put into the market economically, to quote Mike Nichols again, it's a game changer. And I think environmentally it's a good program. I'd rather that we burn gas than coal as a consumer. And again, as it affects the water, we're just not seeing it. So I think it's an environmentally sound resource to develop.
From my standpoint, I would say that you can develop natural resources without harming the environment. It can be done.
Well, both of you have been riveting today on this subject, and you've been extremely informative, and I want to thank you both very much for taking your time to be with us. This has been some pretty informative and serious stuff, and your being with us has been greatly appreciated.
Well, thank you. We enjoyed doing it.
Yes, we did.
Okay, there you have it. The skeptics have been answered. My son, the computer engineer, who's concerned about fracking, and of course my good friend Lee Goldberg, who does a lot of energy and environmental stories all the time, who's very concerned about it. You've just listened to Mike Pack, the executive director of the Groundwater Protection Council, a national organization headquartered in, I believe, Oklahoma City. And Mike Nicholas is one of his more valuable geologists, who also is with the Groundwater Protection Agency. Keep in mind that alternative energy is a big study going out of the 4th Annual Green Technologies Conference in Tulsa, April 19th and 20th at the Southern Hills Hilton Hotel, and the public is urged to attend by registering at the website, and you can see that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, on the right-hand side of your screen.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I would say persistence is a key to accomplishing your goals. It was on the back of my first girlfriend's father's business card, and he said, you can have talent, you can have resources, but persistence is absolutely key to getting to your goals, and that was part of what happened with us. I, early on, gave a talk with my father on this technology, and after the talk, an older gentleman came up to me and said, son, he said, it sounds like a very interesting technology, but he said, you're way too excited about this. He said, it takes at least 25 years to become standard in this industry. And I turned around, I thought he didn't know what he was talking about, but he was correct. Persistence is key to success. My name is Mark McCracken. I'm the CEO of CalMac Manufacturing Corporation, and I'm also the chairman of the board of U.S. Green Building Council.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.